Picture this. It's the morning of May 8, 1945. Somewhere over the Austrian Alps, a flight of P-47 Thunderbolts from the 511th Fighter Squadron is pounding a rail yard near the town of Ebensee. The war in Europe ended hours ago, word hasn't quite reached everybody yet, and these boys are flying what turns out to be one of the very last combat missions of the European theater. One of those jugs is named Dottie May, and in about 20 minutes she's going into a lake. I'm Taildragger, this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because today I want to tell you about one of the most remarkable warbird restorations of our lifetime. A Thunderbolt that spent 60 years underwater and came back flying. Before we get too deep, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on in the hangar today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, tailwheel endorsement all the way up to your type ratings and your ATP. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every coin tells a story. That's AviationSoul.com. Now, back to Dottie May. She was a Republic P-47D Thunderbolt, a Razorback variant, not the bubble canopy model most folks picture when they hear Thunderbolt. Serial number 42-75971. She rolled out of the Republic plant on Long Island in the summer of 1943. Twin row radial up front, that great big Pratt and Whitney R-2800 double wasp. 18 cylinders breathing through a turbo supercharger the size of a beer keg tucked down in the belly. 850 caliber Browning machine guns in the wings. 7 tons empty, closer to 9 tons loaded. She was the biggest single-seat, single-engine fighter of the war, and she could take punishment like no other. The pilot who flew her that last mission was a 22-year-old from Pennsylvania named First Lieutenant Larry Cool. He'd already been flying combat for months with the 405th Fighter Group, the famous Raiders, operating out of an advanced airfield in Kitzingen, Germany. Now here's where it gets interesting. Cool didn't actually name the airplane. Dottie May was the girl back home of another pilot in the squadron, a fellow by the name of Robert Keller. But squadron airplanes got shared around, and on that morning of May 8th, Cool drew Dottie May from the ready line. The mission was straightforward on paper, a low-level strafing run on German rail stock near Ebensee, Austria, tucked up against the Totzgebirge Mountains, beautiful country, lakes like sheets of blue glass between the peaks. The kind of scenery that would make you forget there was a war on if the war hadn't been following you around for 3 years. Cool rolled in low, real low, that's how the Raiders did business. Down in the weeds where the flak gunners had a hard time getting a beat on you, he hammered a string of boxcars, saw them cook off and pulled up over the burning rail yard, and that's when a piece of his own target came up and got him. See, one of those rail cars had been loaded with ammunition. When Cool's 50s ignited it, the whole thing went up like a Roman candle. Debris, shrapnel, pieces of steel the size of dinner plates flung up into the air. Dottie May flew right through it, took a chunk of something unfriendly through the oil cooler. The big Pratt and Whitney started pumping oil all over the windscreen within seconds. Cool pulled up, climbed for altitude, and started looking for somewhere, anywhere, to put her down. Now. Picture being in that cockpit. Oil smeared across the glass so thick you can barely see. Engine temperature climbing, the airplane shuddering. And below you, nothing but alpine terrain, pine forest, jagged rock, villages with narrow streets. No wheat fields, no grass strips, not a friendly piece of ground anywhere, but there was water. Lake Tronzi. A long, deep, cold alpine lake. Cool circled once, dropped his canopy and set up for a water landing. He brought her in with the gear up, of course, eased her onto the surface like he was greasing one onto a 3,000-foot strip. She skipped once, settled, and started to sink. He had time to get clear. Scrambled out onto the wing as she went nose down, climbed onto the fuselage, and stepped off into the water just as Dottie May slid under the surface and disappeared. He was picked up by a local in a rowboat, a civilian, and that's something to sit with for a minute. The war had ended that very morning. This Austrian fellow could have let the American sink. Instead, he rowed out and pulled a stranger into his boat. Cool walked back to his unit a few days later. Dottie May went to the bottom, 150 feet down in Lake Tronsi, where she settled into the silt, upright and mostly intact, and there she sat. Through the occupation, through the Marshall Plan, through the Cold War, through Korea, Vietnam, the moon landing, the jet age, the space shuttle. 60 years in water so cold it might as well have been a time capsule. Now, let me tell you something about cold, deep, fresh water. It is the single best environment on Earth for preserving an airplane. No salt to eat the aluminum, no sunlight to cook the rubber, very little oxygen at depth, and the water in Lake Tronsi sits right around 40 degrees Fahrenheit year-round. A P-47 that would have been a pile of rust after 6 months in salt water was still, recognizably, a P-47, 60 years later. Here's where we take a breath, because the second half of this story is every bit as good as the first. In 2003, an Austrian dive team located the wreck. Word got around. and in 2005, an American named Alan Tolley, working with Austrian authorities and local divers, organized a recovery operation. Now, pulling an airplane up out of 150 feet of water is not like lifting a Cessna 172 out of a cornfield. You've got to rig her underwater. You've got to float her in stages. You've got to do it without breaking her further than she's already been broken. They used lift bags. Big industrial lift bags, the kind used to raise shipwrecks. Divers spent weeks clearing silt out of the cockpit, freeing the control surfaces, rigging the airframe. When she finally broke the surface of Lake Tronsi, 60 years after she went under, there was still oil in the engine crankcase. Still 45 caliber rounds, unfired, in the ammo trays. Still the faint outline of squadron markings on the fuselage. The gun camera was recovered. Cool's parachute was recovered. Pieces of his logbook. It was as if the lake had been waiting. She came out of the water and went into storage. Eventually, after some legal back and forth and some changes of ownership, she made her way to a little town in northern Minnesota. Bemidji, Minnesota, home of a shop called Air Corps Aviation. And this is where the real magic happens. Because pulling a warbird out of a lake is one thing. Making her fly again is another thing entirely. Air Corps Aviation is run by a fellow named Eric Hokoff and a team of craftsmen, men and women who have forgotten more about 1940s aircraft construction than most of us will ever know. When Dottie Mae arrived at their shop, she was a puzzle with most of the pieces there, but most of them needing to be remade, skin corroded beyond use, spars that had to be examined, rivet by rivet, control cables that had turned to powder, a fuselage frame that needed to be disassembled down to individual components, inspected, repaired, or replaced, and rebuilt using original 1940s techniques. They didn't just restore her. They built her back the way Republic built her the first time. Hand-formed skins, correct rivet patterns, period-correct fasteners. They went hunting for a correct data plate Pratt & Whitney R2800. They tracked down a correct turbo supercharger unit. They restored the original gun sight, the original Curtiss electric propeller hub. When they couldn't find an original part, they fabricated one from scratch using the original factory drawings, which, God bless the United States Air Force archives, still exist. 12 years. That's how long the restoration took. 12 years of steady, patient, obsessive work. 12 years of a team of people deciding day after day that they would not compromise, that this airplane was going to come back the way she was. Back when AVGS was cheap and airspace was free, airplanes like Dottie Mae were everywhere. By the end of the war, the United States had built more than 15,600 Thunderbolts. Today, of all those 15,600 airframes, there are fewer than a dozen flyable P-47s on the entire planet. Fewer than a dozen. Every single one of them is a miracle. On August 5, 2017, Dottie Mae rolled out of the Air Corps Aviation Hangar in Bemidji, Minnesota, paint fresh invasion stripes crisp as newsprint, engine ticking and muttering the way a double wasp does when it's warm and happy. Test pilot Bernie Vasquez strapped in, taxied out, and pushed the throttle forward. Now I want you to imagine the sound. If you have never heard an R2800 at full chat, I am sorry, because there is nothing else quite like it. 18 cylinders of angry American horsepower, a deep throaty, rolling thunder that you feel in your chest before you hear it with your ears. The pitch rises, the airframe leans forward, and Dottie Mae, who had been drowned for 6 decades, lifted off a Minnesota runway and climbed into the summer sky. She flew. The first person to fly her in 62 years was Vasquez. The second person to get inside that cockpit after the first flight was a guest of honor. They'd flown him in from his home in Pennsylvania, a 94-year-old gentleman, a little stooped now, but still sharp, still carrying himself like the fighter pilot he had been. First Lieutenant Larry Cool climbed up on the wing of the airplane he had ditched in an alpine lake on the last day of the war in Europe. He sat down in the cockpit, he put his hands on the controls, and by every account from the people who were there that day, he didn't say much at first, he just sat. Maybe he was listening for something. Maybe he was remembering what the oil had looked like on the windscreen 72 years before. Maybe he was counting his blessings, which at 94 you tend to do. Larry Cool passed away in 2020, but he lived long enough to touch that airplane again. He lived long enough to know that Dottie Mae had come home. She's based now at the Lewis Air Legends Collection in San Antonio, Texas. You can see her at air shows. She flies. She shows up at Oshkosh. She flew at the Sun End Fun Gathering down in Lakeland. She is, in every sense, alive. Here's why this story matters to me, and why I wanted to spend a Sunday afternoon talking about it. Restoration is not nostalgia. It is not sentimentality. It is the deliberate, disciplined act of refusing to let something important disappear. When the craftsmen at Air Corps Aviation spent 12 years rebuilding an airplane that most reasonable people would have written off as scrap, they were doing something that the rest of the culture is rarely willing to do anymore. They were saying, this thing was worth building right the first time, and it is worth building right the second time. And we will take as long as it takes. That's not just an airplane story. That's a way of being in the world. Every warbird flying today, every Mustang, every Corsair, every Mitchell, every Jug exists because somebody, somewhere, decided not to let it go, decided the hours and the money and the sweat were worth it. Those airplanes are flying memorials to the people who built them, to the people who flew them, and to the people who saved them from the scrapper's torch. So the next time you see a P-47 at an air show, and you hear that big round engine rumbling over the flight line, I want you to think about Dottie May. 150 feet down in an Austrian lake, for 60 years waiting, and then a shop full of patient people in northern Minnesota, putting her back together one rivet at a time. That is what love looks like when it's expressed in aluminum and sheet metal. Most of what I shared today came from Air Corp Aviation's own beautifully documented restoration blog, plus reporting from Warbird Digest, EAA's Warbirds magazine, and an interview with Larry Cool that ran in the Lancaster newspaper a few years before he passed. If you want to see Dottie May for yourself, photographs and video of her first flight are all over the place, and you can find more stories like hers over at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up, and if you're lucky enough to see a Jug in the air this summer, tip your hat. She's been waiting a long time to fly.